it's good to be here tonight. Thank you so much for asking me. I didn't realize that I was like the end of it. So I'm just going to wrap it up based on what I know so much about anything. I'm just kidding. No, it really is a privilege to be here at the 20s thing. I kind of missed that demographic by about a decade. So I thought, man, I really was going to like try to dress cool. But I honestly, I haven't taken a shower since Friday. We're supposed to be transparent here, right? Authenticity. I got pooped on before I left the house. Just someone said, by who? And I'm like, I can't even remember. It was all happening so fast. I have a four-year-old and twin two-year-olds, and we're potty training the twins, and it's just ugly. It's just so ugly. So suffering. That's what, I'm just kidding. No, I'll tell you, my name's Laura, and I have been on staff here for a little over 11 years with Worship and Arts, and it's interesting even how we kind of began the evening, lay me down. I love and hate that bridge. It will be my joy to say, your will, your way. I'm singing that, and as I'm singing that, there's this voice in my head going, liar. You're a liar. It's like, you're right. I don't believe that at all. Like, it's not on my best day. I would say it's more of a willingness than a joy. I want it to be a joy. You know, I began my time here. I had just gotten married to my high school sweetheart, Martin, and it was kind of this fairy tale story, and we had, you know, when you're getting married, you kind of have some sort of plan for your life that I had so kindly drafted up for God so that all he needed to do was sign off on it. And it didn't take very long at all to figure out that God really isn't the kind of God that likes to sign off on our plan that we draft up for him for our lives. But really, he is about bringing us to a place of trust and surrender where we say, it will be my joy to say, your will, your way. And I think I can stand before you and say that on some level, but it's been a long process. We came here, we'd been married about a year, and it's kind of like, I was, before we came here, Martin was doing campus ministry at a little college called Wofford College. I was playing upright bass in a bluegrass band at a Mexican restaurant. Yeah, I know. It was a great gig. They gave me like all the free burritos I could eat, which was really special. Anyway, Martin kind of felt led to go to grad school, and we had literally packed all our boxes. They all said Savannah on them. We were heading to Savannah College of Art and Design. And a friend of ours here, who Martin knew from college, called him and said, hey, I noticed that there's a campus that has just opened up, a SCAD campus right here in Atlanta. And our church is looking for someone to do a little bit of women's ministry, a little bit of worship stuff, which was just so much my heart. And so, you know, as I even remember after we got here, the kind people from the church that were helping us unload the boxes, they were like, hey, all these boxes that say Savannah, do they come in too? And we're like, yes. Yeah, we had our plan, and God had his plan. And that part of the plan has ended up just being truly such a blessing to come and be part of this church for the past 11 years. But those of you who know our story, as soon as we got here, I had been on staff for probably about 5 months before Martin started having some pretty severe health symptoms. And within, I guess, less than about 9 months of being here, Martin ended up having to have brain surgery. He was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And that was, you know, even thinking back to it, it was kind of a blur. We were so young and naive that when we heard the news, he had had some health stuff going on for maybe 6-9 months that we just hadn't quite been able to figure out what was wrong. And so in a lot of ways, we were thankful to get the diagnosis. It's like, okay, we know what it is. He can go in and have surgery. We can get this fixed. We can get back to the plan, you know? And I remember even sitting with the doctor that very first time, and as this young, clueless couple, and he's telling us about the brain surgery that Martin needed, And he said that it was even a possibility that based on this surgery, that Martin might wake up and not remember anything about his life beforehand. Like not remember his parents, not remember who he was, where we lived, who I was, all of that. And so we were pretty terrified going into it. But sure enough, as soon as I got to see him that first moment after his surgery, as soon as our eyes met, he said, "Laura Story." And I thought, oh, he remembers me. And then he said, "What are you doing here?" Which was, that was my first clue that he knew exactly who I was, but he had no idea that we were married, which is very odd news to break to your spouse. And I'm thinking, this guy's just had brain surgery. I don't, like, how much bad news can he take in one day? So I finally kind of got up the courage to say, the reason why I'm here with you is I'm your wife. You gave me this ring, and we have the same last name. We walked down the aisle together. I wore the white dress. You had the tux on. Like, I'm trying to give as many details as I can think of. And he's looking at me like I've just lost my mind. And he finally says, "We're married?" "Yes." Which I kind of feel like is the best way that can go down. But it was the beginning of this. It's like there was the road of life, and it began to take this detour. And we're like, okay, cool, we're okay with a detour. But after months and months of it never quite getting back to the way that we thought it would be, we started to realize that the detour was actually the road. And I bet if we went around and if I had the chance to ask you guys, you know, have you ever been through a time in your life that you really thought you knew the plan, and all of a sudden it starts to veer off in a direction that maybe you're a little bit less certain about, less expected, and at some point in time you go, okay, is this really the good plan that God has for me? Is this really, you know, God, you tell me that you know the plans, and they're plans for prosperity and not for calamity. Is this really the plan? So that's kind of where we found ourselves. Even, you know, after that initial surgery, we had this, I remember that neurosurgeon gave us the pamphlet about this particular procedure, and it talked about the 5 days that we would spend at Emory University Hospital. Day one was brain surgery. Day two and three, it was going to be Martin in the ICU, and day four, he was going to be moved to a regular room, and day five, he would be discharged. And I remember thinking, okay, we got this plan. This is great. You know, this is, it was the guy that wrote the book on this kind of surgery. So I was feeling confident about this. Well, probably after about a week and a half of being in the ICU, Martin was moved to a regular room. And about 2 weeks later, he was discharged from the hospital, finally, but only to be home for about 10 days and then to be readmitted with a brain fluid leak from his nose. And when he was readmitted, they began to make more plans for surgery. But between the time that he was admitted and the time he was able to have the surgery, ended up contracting a brain infection called meningitis. And that's when I remember that night so clearly, because I had, you know, stayed at the hospital this whole time and been right by his side. And someone said, "Hey, you've got to go home and get some rest and take a shower. You've got to go take a shower." But I remember being sent home and sleeping in my bed for the first time without him in so long, and getting that phone call at 3 a.m. from his mom, just completely hysterical, saying, you know, he's coded, he's not breathing, they've hooked him up to machines, and rushing back down to the hospital and sitting in that ICU room with him for the next 5 weeks, you know, with those first few nights just being really, just we were unsure whether he would wake up from, you know, from the evening to the morning. And eventually, finally, recovered enough to be sent to a regular room. And then finally, recovered enough to be sent to a step-down unit. Right up here at Joan Glancy, if you guys are familiar with Duluth, they have a little inpatient rehab facility there. And it was the first time, it was the most normal our lives had been in months. Because it was the first time that we got to sit at a table and eat dinner. I know this sounds kind of weird, but he'd been in the hospital eating, like, mush, you know, first of all through a tube, and then mush, and then solid food, but all, like, sitting in his hospital bed. And so we're sitting at this table for the first time, and it was just so exciting. I know that sounds silly, but it was just so exciting. And he was in a wheelchair. He couldn't talk very well at that time. And I remember we were eating spaghetti, and I'm showing him how to use his fork and his knife together to cut his spaghetti. And he sees at the table next to us this guy using Parmesan cheese on his spaghetti, and he looks at me and points and says, "Cheese, cheese." And I thought, oh, he remembers that he likes cheese on his spaghetti. This is great. And so I said, "Can we get him some of that Parmesan cheese?" And the sweet cafeteria worker brought it over, and Martin opened the cheese all by himself. And I was just so proud of him. And he poured it right into his milk, got his spoon, started stirring up his cheese milk. And I remember thinking, you know, looking back at the plan, that cheese milk, like, it's not on the plan, God. But it was the beginning of me really coming to terms with the fact that whatever plan I had for our lives, it wasn't just that things have gone off course. It was like it had been obliterated. It was like there was no even resemblance to this thing that we thought our lives would look like. And that was kind of the final confirmation of that for me was a few weeks later when we were finally discharged from that hospital. And as thankful as I was that we got to go home, it was a very different kind of feeling than the first time we were discharged. Because the first time we were joyful, he was hopping in the car. This time I'm rolling him out in a wheelchair. And even the walking part, like, I knew that eventually he would be able to walk again. Because the doctors had said, you know, he'll be able to walk again. He's going to be able to talk. He's really going to, you know, these areas we are more than confident he's going to be able to excel in and get back to where he was. They said, but he has suffered a pretty traumatic brain injury. And they began to kind of frame what the rest of our lives would look like. And from what they told us, it's been now 10 years. It was pretty accurate, kind of what they told us that our lives would look like now. And Martin lives with a brain injury with short-term memory deficit. He only has 50% of his vision. And I could tell you so many things of what that means for him and for our family. He's unable to drive. He works part-time and really is highly functional for someone who's been through what he's been through. And I could tell you 1,000 details about that. But what I want to tell you is what we found to be equally hard to adjusting to this new normal, you know, doing life with a brain injury, with a disability. What was equally hard is beginning to come to terms with this on a spiritual level. Because we had both grown up our whole lives believing, you know, that God is all good. He is all powerful. He can move the mountains. He can, you know, we knew all of this. But we were living in the midst of just such brokenness in our lives and our families, and really struggled to know how to really reconcile who we knew God to be with how broken our circumstances still seemed, and trying to figure out, so all those promises that I've read in this book, do they still apply to us? Like, where's the breakdown here? And I want to share just from the standpoint of a worship leader, because so we leave the hospital, I get back to work. You know, logistically, I'm finally at a place, you know, Martin was coming to work with me, and I'm finally at a place where I'm able to come back and do my job that this church had hired me to do. You know, they're professional How Great Is Our God singer. Like, that's kind of what I do here. And each time I would get up on that stage in there, I couldn't figure out how to do it. Like, I knew the songs, and part of it was God had was using the brokenness, was using the different path, the different story, the different plan to really redefine my definition of worship. I think I'd thought before, you know, we're going to sing some happy songs, we're going to be happy, and, you know, people are going to come in and be happy to each other, and everybody's got smiles, and I'm going to sing happy songs about happy stuff. And I was just so broken, I just didn't even know how to do it. And what it forced me to do is come back to this book and ask God, what is worship? I believe that it's something you want me to do, when I'm in the valley as well as in the mountain, on the mountaintop, but I need you to show me what your word has to say about worship. And I began to look through passage after passage, and I've met Abraham and Isaac for the first time. You know, that very first time that you see the word worship, it's a guy who's been asked, take now your son, your only son whom you love. It's as if God's like kind of turning the knife, as, you know, as he's asking it. And you see worship being this tearful moment of surrender, this tearful moment of obedience. Or you see a guy like Paul who is singing about the richest freedom he's ever known from a jail cell. He's singing about joy, you know, when he's literally looking at the fact that his life is going to end. And so I just began to understand worship in a new and fresh way. And I want to, just for a few minutes, I want to show you just Psalm 40. Well, the Psalms as a whole ended up being so much of a lifeline for me. You know, if you guys... I'm sure that you know about the book of Psalms, but just kind of a recap. It was that hymnal of the Old Testament people. It was somewhat of a script. I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean in a very positive way, in the sense that, like, when we don't know what to say to God, we can turn to the Psalms. When we don't have the words, which I was in a place of saying, God, I'm so broken. I literally don't even have the words to say to you. And he said, that's okay. He gave us some. And so the one I want to look at and just share a few quick thoughts about is Psalm 40. And we're going to have this up on the screen. Yes. Just the first three verses. Let me read it for us. I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog, and set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. This is kind of a mini testimony of David. And just three quick thoughts just to think about in this passage. Three quick, maybe, characteristics of David's worship. First of all, his worship incorporated his story. And I want to hear from you guys. What is David's story? First of all, and let's kind of go easy on him. Let's start with the good stuff. Who was David?
King.
Yes.
Son of Jesse.
Son of Jesse. Redheaded. You say redheaded? I didn't know that. You sure? I'm just kidding. Who else? He was a shepherd, man after God's own heart. You guys are missing like the most godly characteristic.
Warrior.
Oh, yes, that too. He was a musician. A songwriter, Colin. Have my back here, man. No. So a lot of great things about his story, and maybe some not so great things being, yeah, that whole Bathsheba incident. And that leading to, yes, so he's adulterer, murderer. Does anyone remember what happened before the Bathsheba incident that kind of got him in the mess in the first place? So you're right. So that would have been after. This is more like when all the people went off to war, he didn't go. So like the commander of the military stayed back. So I kind of feel bad a little bit for Bathsheba, you know, because it's like, oh, she's hanging out on a roof naked. But there weren't really supposed to be any men there, even though, like, I still wouldn't do that. But it's beside the point. But we have this stuff. And there's some other stuff, like even thinking about what else, like maybe stuff that wasn't his fault. Yeah. So this guy is spending a good portion of his life running from people who are trying to kill him. And even, I can't remember whether it was Saul or Absalom, I think it was Saul, where he had this opportunity. Saul, who am I thinking of? Yeah, okay, it was Saul. He has this opportunity to take his life, but still, out of honor to God, chooses to not kill the guy who's trying to murder him. So you see some integrity in that. But the thing with David's story that I want us to think about is, regardless of how good of a guy he was, because honestly, if we did this about, let's say we did this about Caleb. So let's tell some good, you know, how Like, we can all kind of relate to if someone was to get a whiteboard out and to talk about what our story is, you know, some highlights and some lowlights. But the truth is, no matter what pit David jumped into or fell into or was pushed into, it's amazing to see that God's arm of redemption is always long enough to reach. That there's not a single part of David's story that made him too far gone for redemption or disqualified from being used for being called a man after God's own heart. And you kind of see this synopsis. He doesn't tell everything about it. But could you go back to verse 1 real quick? He doesn't go into detail, but he talks about, I even love this, he talks about kind of what his role is and a little bit, you know, as far as what God's role is. So what was David's role in his worship, according to this scripture? He waited patiently. Two of my least favorite words in the scriptures. I remember being in a time in my life of just going through a really, really rough patch a few years ago and meeting with a pastor here and him saying, oh, Laura, I really feel like you just need to wait on the Lord. And I was like, that is exactly right. Tell me what, so what do I do to wait? He's like, you're not getting it. It's waiting on the Lord. It's being still. But what I love about that is that David waited patiently, but God did the rest. You know, he's the one that heard him and drew him out of that pit and set his feet on a firm foundation. And just this reminder of no matter what your story is, it can't disqualify you from being used by God or being loved by God. And David's just such a great illustration of this. But secondly, so David's worship, we see an incorporation of his story, but secondly, we see a declaration of God's glory. And if we can go to, I have this somewhere in here. How about one more slide, and I'll stay on that next one. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. You think about everything that David went through, the fact that he chose blessing over bitterness, the fact that everything he went through, it could have given him reason just to run, but instead he chooses, he says that God put a new song in his mouth, a song of praise to our God. That word and a new song, it could be a new song, you know, we learned a new song tonight, or it could be a song newly, kind of sung in a new way. There was something new and fresh in David's heart. One thing I love about David's writings in the Psalms is we have things like Psalm 34 that says, I will bless the Lord at all times. It doesn't say, I feel like blessing the Lord at all times. For me, sometimes worship is like exercise. I'm not a big exerciser. Like, I actually, the last time I can think of running, I was at school and there was a donut shop like two blocks from our school and it was closing. And so I literally ran to get a donut before it closed. So that's my running habits. I'm not a big exerciser, but the reason I still do sometimes because I like the results and I usually feel better after I've done it. And I think that sometimes it's okay to approach worship like that. It's not like, oh, I feel like blessing God at all time. I feel like singing his praises all the time. It's like, no, I'm going to make that volitional effort to worship God because it's the best thing for my soul, because he's always worthy of our praises. Psalm, I think it's 103, you know, bless the Lord, O my soul. He's commanding his soul, bless God. I'll tell you what, one more quick psalm, Psalm 13. It's just six short verses. But I love David's honesty, and I love that God included it in this. It's not like David accidentally tweeted this when he was having a tough day. Like God intentionally put this in the Bible, I think for all of us, to show us how much God delights in us being honest. But he says, how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and answer me, O Lord my God. Light up my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death, lest my enemies say I have prevailed over him, lest my foes rejoice when I am shaken. And so those four verses are just David being really honest about how he feels. And so I feel like he kind of begins like this. How long? I mean, has anyone ever felt that way? God, I just feel like you're hiding from me. I feel like you've abandoned us. Your plan is so different than mine. It just feels unkind. It feels unjust. But I love that David kind of moves from a posture of this, really to a posture of this, because he says, but I have trusted in your loving kindness. My heart will rejoice in your salvation. You can move to the next one. My heart will rejoice in your salvation, and I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me. He says, how I feel is real and valid, and I'm going to share that with the Lord, but this isn't what reigns. How I feel about my circumstances, how I feel about myself. This is all real and valid, but it doesn't reign. What's true is that I'm going to trust in God's steadfast love. My heart shall rejoice in my salvation. It's like, regardless of how crappy my day, can I say crappy in the chapel? Don't tell them that I did that. No matter how crappy my day is, my week is, my year, if the only good thing that's ever happened in my life is the fact that God saved me, I will rejoice in that salvation. And I will sing, not because I'm having a great day, not because I understand God's plan for me, not because I agree with God's will for me, but I will sing to the Lord because he's dealt bountifully with me. It's because I can look back on my life and see a track record of faithfulness. Even everything we've walked through, as hard as it's been, and honestly as disappointing at times as it's been, when I look back on our lives, especially the past 10 years, the thing I can definitely say is there's never been a moment that he's left us alone. There's never been a promise that he hasn't kept. There's never been a need that he hasn't met. And even in the midst, I know that this sounds like something cheesy that people that walk through hard stuff say, because I used to think, oh, that's something cheesy people say, going through hard stuff. But I really believe it now. When I look at what God has taught me, the intimacy, the byproduct has been me clinging to Jesus in a more desperate way than I ever imagined before. I wouldn't trade that for anything. I really wouldn't. So it's choosing blessing over bitterness. I want to share just quick, I carry this around because my soul needs it, but it's some quotes by Corrie Ten Boom. And she, for you guys that don't know, she was born in 1892. She was a Dutch Christian who, along with her father and her other family members, they helped many Jews escape from Nazi Holocaust during World War II. And they were all imprisoned for their actions, and many of her family members died. And she was actually released due to a clerical error. And when later, as she kind of told her story, she would say about that, about her release, she says, God does not have problems, only plans. And one of the two things that quotes that I've just always loved, she says, never be afraid to trust an unknown future to a known God. I thought that was good. She also says, worry does not empty tomorrow of its sorrow, it empties today of its strength. So you see someone who, I could read more about it, but someone who went through some of the most horrific torture and seeing family members die and all of that, but in every moment she chose this over this. And I'll tell you, I've learned that this has its place, but it just never really gains much traction. You know, it's not that you move from bitterness to blessing because you gain this greater understanding necessarily of why this has happened to you. Or maybe you're this way because of something that someone's done to you. It's not necessarily that you move from here to here because that person asks for forgiveness or changes their behavior. You move from here to here because you do it for your own soul. You do it because where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's liberty. You do it because there's a freedom that comes from saying, I'm no longer going to live in a place of bitterness. I'm going to believe, I'm going to choose to trust my unknown future to a known God. I remember a long time ago, a youth leader giving me a definition of God's sovereignty. He said, sovereignty is believing that everything that enters into my life has been filtered through the hands of a loving God. Believing everything that has entered into my life has been filtered through the hands of a loving God. And that's part of moving from bitterness to blessing. And I'm going to get the guys to come back up here. But lastly, you know, in David's worship, we see an incorporation of his story. It's not that we check our stories at the door when we come to worship. We see a declaration of God's glory. But lastly, we see an expectation of the extraordinary. And if we can put that verse up one last time. David talks about this new song that God has put in his mouth. And he says, many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. And I remember, you know, as a songwriter hearing this, and it sounded kind of funny to me that like a songwriter was like, man, I've got this great new song. And when people hear it, they're just going to like fall to their faces and repent. It's just going to be amazing. It's just going to be widespread revival through Perimeter Church as soon as I play for them my new song. You know? And the more you kind of study the text, that's not really what he's saying. It's not that he's boasting in the greatness of his song, but he's boasting in the greatness of his God. But the key is that our great God is seen through our songs. He's seen when we choose to worship in the midst of brokenness. He's seen through the story of our life and how rather than responding like this, and it's us allowing God to kind of peel back those fingers and say, you know, surrender your brokenness to me. Surrender your suffering to me. Surrender that part of your story that you don't like, that you never ask for. Surrender to me, you know, that deepest hurt, because I believe that, you know, like we've been hearing with this new series, God just didn't just come to redeem people. It's not just about like hanging on until he gets there. God has come to redeem all things, and even the most broken things in our life, I believe, are redeemable, and I believe that's his desire. So I'd love, let's do this. I liked that one you did at the end, the winds and waves and stuff. What was that?
It is well.
Let's do that. Do you mind playing for a second while I pray for us?
Sure.
Father, I pray that you spoke through my mess. But I want to take a moment now for each of us to think about that clenched fist, to think about that thing in our life that is hardest to surrender to you. Maybe it's our singleness. Maybe it's a job that we've prayed that would change and we're just still stuck in it. Maybe it's a relationship with a friend or family or parent that's strained that you haven't brought healing to yet. Maybe our lives just look so, so different than the plan we had for ourselves, Lord. Would you soften our hearts and give us the faith to surrender that to you, God? Not because we understand it, not because we like it, but just because we trust you. And just because we know that surrender, as a believer, surrender is the best and most natural things for our souls, God. Just draw us to that place as we sing.